front is my husband got swabbed and was positive for coronavirus. He's fine, but we're on lockdown for 14 days, each of us. We're slightly off schedule, so mine's not until the 14th. I'm well. He's okay. If you didn't know, you'd think he just had a cold. The irony is that we've gone to a lot of measures to try and protect his 90, 91-year-old mother, and it looks like she might have been the weak link and gave it to him. So, and she's doing okay. So it's there. It's there, just in case you were wondering. After 6 months of doing all of this stuff, it's still out there. So, but all is well, other than we're cloistered. And of course, I think I've mentioned this before, I'm kind of cloistered by nature, but the minute you have to be, suddenly you have this great desire to go out and things like that. But I am allowed to walk the dog because I'm not symptomatic. So, and the dog is not allowed to go up to Ian because they're not sure about that. So the dog is quite confused as to what the heck is going on. So let's begin here. So last week, I introduced the kind of the notion of the history of the Paramitas, or the perfections of the Bodhisattva. And just for a quick review, those will be generosity, ethical conduct, patience, tolerance, joyful effort, meditation, and wisdom. And then we kind of looked at the perfections as being, in my mind, a bit of like the training manual for the bodhisattvas. That's how we kind of engage in our practice, and that it introduces the concept of having our compass point being directed by vows versus karma. And then to get around the whole concept of perfections, because that can be a bit daunting, we looked at terms that from our other writers, where instead of perfections, to consider them more like practices that spark the imagination, build character, inspire hope, ways to study the self and examine. And then we were looking at the imagery of the balanced wheel. I talked a little bit about the neurophysiological science of the brain and under the nervous system. And under that lens, hoping that there's slightly a greater appreciation for the bag of chemicals, nerves of our primitive brain, and some degree of insight to the functions of our higher brain. But sort of the bottom line is that how our minds and our bodies are both brilliant and a bit dumb at the same time. So it, and some of this we can speak to our nervous system, and the one key player is the soul nerve or the vagus nerve that has a lot to do with how we interpret our world. Now, I forgot to cue it up. I had a share screen, but do I have permission here? Can I get it? River, are you there? Can you?
Hold on, I can have you share screen just a sec.
Find it, because it was quite cute. So, the upside of Zoom, okay, so you can do things like
go
that.
Go for it.
Okay, let's see, share. Okay, so let me just, sorry. I got to pull it up. Where did I put you? Oh, here it is. Okay. So this was... Oh, crumb. Okay, let's share. Okay, here we go. And I came across this, and I thought this was kind of perfect on body, and it's this is Liz Klimo. She's one of my favorite cartoonists. It's, how do you know if you're doing the right thing? You just know. You feel it in your gut. I don't really know where that is. It's a little sneak. I thought, that's really perfect for this thing. So, yeah, I'll give you some cuteness to start off with. And then last week we played around with a little bit of body practice that required a lot of faith and imagination on everybody's part here. So, So this week, as generosity, Kate has spoken and given you some introduction to generosity on her Wednesday, on the Wednesday series. So you'll hear some repetition and hopefully some new stuff. And so I've started with the notion of what the books are saying. You know, why do we begin with generosity? Because our practice, you know, we tend to start with meditation, it seems, you know. And according to some of our great writers here, the one at the top of the list is the one that opens the door. So that would be one. Giving is the warm heart of the Bodhisattva's practice, from Reb Anderson. And generosity is the gateway to the Bodhisattva path. So we have folks like Wright who talk about more of the traditions and saying, you know, in the Mahayana tradition, the two most essential characteristics of an enlightened character are wisdom and compassion. But the reason for generosity, subordination to compassion, is that when compassion is fully present, a separate concern for generosity is unnecessary. So generosity, in his view, is to inaugurate or to begin the movement towards compassion, to plant and cultivate its seeds in our minds, in our character. And then when we look at sort of more images and ways of expressing that, we have obviously Avalokiteshvara with the multiple arms and generous outreach. And from him, we learn one of the first vital skills on being receptive, a sensitive openness to others, noting their need and our receptivity. In sensitivity, we open our minds to the very possibility that someone may need our assistance and welcome their gestures toward us. So, pretty big. So I've looked at this too with the same aspect of the journey. What do you need to put in your toolkit? And with generosity, just like the whole set of paramitas, it begins with some type of intentional resolve. And from Rosetto, she says here, we begin by making an explicit, conscious effort to enact generosity. We make it an outward gesture of our deepest capacity toward letting go into openness. And from Norman, he speaks of it, the resolve, as requiring a fundamental shift in our approach to life. Because the Bodhisattva practice is radical. So it's kind of a resolve to shift. And for his explanation, it asks for an examination of our attitudes and where they come from and how they condition how we see, think, and feel and act. Our attitudes are the climate of our lives, where I'm kind of thinking, you know, maybe part of our character. And he goes on a little bit more too to talk about, it literally means our stance, how you hold your body, your posture, the way you stride forth into your life. So you have attitude informing your posture, informing your approach. And these things are all shaped by our experiences. They're not fixed. But in order to enact or practice, we'd have to take a big leap into the imagination. I'm quite fond of his line here, the perfection of generosity confronts and softens our basic attitudes. And I really like that notion of softening and sort of like looking at them, giving them a little exploration, a little massage here and there, just to, you know, as opposed to confronts. I mean, confronts feels a little harsh, you know, but have a, you know, a nice look, a nice gentle look, and start working and massaging it. Because it's not a given. It's not an absolute given, our expression of generosity. So he talks more about, to practice generosity is to appreciate the natural abundance of being, the inherent generosity of time and space. Life itself is generous. It's abundant, expansive, never stingy or small-minded. You don't need to create. You just have to let it in. And then he goes on to talk about the story of the Tang Dynasty Zen Master Baijiang when he was asked, why giving is the gateway to the Bodhisattva path? And his response, it's to practice giving is to practice letting go of narrow views, of the idea that things are small and tight, graspable and possessible. The open and wide spirit of generosity shows us the stinginess, crabbiness of our minds and thoughts that keep us from opening to the abundance that must be within us. So that's sort of. And then we have other attitudes and approaches that came across in the reading, Rosetto and Okamura, kind of on mindsets. And it was kind of interesting because Rosetto, Diane talked about using these three minds that are described in Buddhist literature. And she was applying it to generosity. I looked it up a little bit more on Okamura. And his description was actually applying it to Zazen. So my conclusion, might be ignorant or naive, is that, well, these are pretty good mindsets for anything that you're approaching. So they talk about Megman. I knew I'd blow this. Big-hearted mind. which inherent human capacity for giving and receiving. It's vast, it's open, inclusive, a not knowing mind, and it avoids attempts to avoid one-sided perspectives, strives to see the whole situation. The second mind is parental or nurturing mind, and that's been described on taking a narrow to wider mind, or the way that parents would think of a child, and their approach and teachings expand and contract as the child matures. And then joyful mind, the happy heart, and the practice of giving joy is given by big-hearted minded people. So, and then Diane talks again a little bit, and I'm going to always pick up on these things, the neurobiology of generosity, and suggests that we can train the brain to respond in certain ways. By engaging in the practice of giving, we can slowly shift our neuronal association from me to we. And of course, I'm going to hop on that one big time, because when we think about our neural networks and pathways, and just as we carve in maybe not so helpful pathways because we're a reactive species and respond to different characteristics of our environment, we also have the capacity to do the opposite. So we have other networks and responses that lead us to things like inducing the serotonin response, the happy chemical, and that reinforces, or oxytocin, which is the bonding and the love. One explanation was the cuddling hormone. And so you can do both. They can kind of, and the more you do of one, the more it hopefully, not so much a displacement because we need them all, but shifts the emphasis. Let's put it that way, which I think would be a reasonable way to describe that. So we get into the discussion of what is given when we're being generous. And we have the classics, material and dharma. And then we have a little bit of discussion about fearlessness that kind of gets tucked in. Now, when I saw that in the readings, I thought, well, now that's really interesting. And it depends on who you read and how you read it. But the more I kind of thought about it, the more I kind of wondered if it shouldn't be kind of one of the first things we talk about, you know, on that. And so my talk. I'm going to talk about it. So these are things like talks. And so we have one here. This is the definition of fearlessness from Vasubandhu, where it's pretty ornate. In an instance where the Bodhisattva observes beings beset by fear of representatives of the king, lions, tigers, wolves, floods, fire, bandits, or insurgents, he, she is able then to rescue and protect him. This is what is meant by the giving of fearlessness. Okay, well, I don't know how many of those representatives we have in our day-to-day life. And Anderson talks about the practice of generosity, protecting and liberating the bodhisattvas from many forms of fear. And so the classic types of fear are loss of life, losing control of our mind, loss of reputation, loss of livelihood, speaking in front of a large assembly. And so I kind of pondered those a little bit and thought, well, those are pretty big. But I was, then I start think, well, you know, we have more relatable fears sometimes, you know, loss of life, fear of flying might be one, losing control of our minds, such as getting it wrong or overreacting. Loss of reputation and being humiliated, you know, on some sort of situation. Loss of livelihood, which is not maybe not the whole thing, but maybe that's the root of our possibly being stingy. And then speaking in front of large assemblies, and maybe that's more around social interactions and attracting or unwelcome attention, either positive or negative. Or even worse, not any. So there might be some more on that. So I just had a little ponder on that. But Anderson continues that bodhisattvas overcome these fears through the practice of generosity. So, and bodhisattvas receive the gift of fearlessness from the Buddhas, and in turn they share it with all sentient beings. In receiving this sets the stage for us to offer this gift to others. And the kind of way I sort of thought is just like when we kind of go on further with giving and receiving and what to give and all of these other things, that I think that's where we kind of have to trust that perhaps a bit of that little crumb of that has been given to us so that we can even approach the topic. Could be one way of looking at it. I might have it all wrong, but that's how I'm looking at it. So Kate talked about the kind of the two things about material things that we give and material and dharma, and that reflects the whole monastic lay person's relationship. So that's how the monastics give, by giving teachings, and the lay give to the monastics. But then we also have some recognitions that it isn't just, especially in modern day, confined to monastics, but that lay folks may also give rise to the ideal level of compassion. Bimala Kirti is one example. And then when I kind of got thinking here about, oh yeah, okay, the teachings, and then you have people like Norman who say maybe the giving teachings initially seems less complicated than material, but it gets into what to say or not, how to say it. What if you're fooling yourself, not realizing that you give great teachings and sound spiritual advice, mostly for the enjoyment of hearing yourself talk in such wonderful words, more than concern for others? Saying words that have been said before doesn't necessarily constitute sound spiritual teaching. So then I'm like, whoa, then you really need a big bag of fearlessness to take that on. So, and then we kind of had some other, these are more my thoughts on where do things like categories that are not material and not necessarily a teaching, so the gift of ourselves, being present, listening, lightness, admiration, or maybe the gift of the Dharma is more modeling, you know, and practicing and showing how it goes, and it's not a spoken thing at all. So, And then the other gift that I wasn't too sure that we offer as Dharma is Anderson talking about our physical bodies offer us the gift of Dharma. Having a body makes it possible to share the Dharma. And then being generous and nurturing to ourselves, eventually see that it depends upon everything that is not our body. And then he talks about different types of things that, like I said, don't neatly fit into the categories. So the gift of feedback, the gift of interpersonal boundaries, the gift of formal boundaries, and seeing our whole lives as a gift. So... I'm just checking my pages, I'm sorry. I think I missed a page. Oh, here it is. Okay. You're on Zoom, you wouldn't think I'd get a bit anxious. So, yeah. It was easier last time, but I don't know. Not this time. It's a little bit harder. So for the bodhisattvas, when they practice generosity wholeheartedly, because they give everything away, and because they're constantly giving everything away, they don't lose anything, and therefore they're not afraid or fears are burned away in the intense joy of generosity. Which is interesting. Diane Rossetto talks about the first Paramita asks us to consider something that we are withholding and to realize the greatest gift we can give is ourselves. And the courage of giving, and the courage of receiving, and opening wide our narrow hand to receive and gift. Then we have Norman who says, maybe this one isn't that complicated. It's an inner gift. You offer your heart, your feeling, giving the gift of your own happiness. And to give the gift of fearlessness is to give others the sense that they matter, that they are respected and cared for, secure within a loving reality, and therefore ultimately protected. You can't fake this. To be capable of giving fearlessness to others, you must have genuine confidence that there is nothing to fear. And when you are fearless, bad things can be okay. So he's not too, he's just, you know, big happy, but it's the approach. And then he goes back, like Reb Anderson too, that the gift is from the Buddhas of before, but it's a gift that requires cultivation. And again, we look at our attitudes, our stance, our approach, what kind of mind. And we open to examine our lives requires a great deal of confidence. So you might, by this point, sort of go, I think I know why she picked fearlessness. Some place to take a look at that. So just give me a second here. I think I got a little lost on my pages here. So then we get into the how to give and what to give. You know, so we have material, money, cash, attitudes, presence, all those kinds of things. We ran through that list on Wednesday before. And so Wright talks about aspects of skillful means and how we give. So one of the first things is who should this generosity be bestowed upon? And the teachings prescribe universal giving, non-discrimination, and impartiality. And the appropriate attitude, no thoughts given to the reward or fruit, or any attitude of self-congratulation. It also points out, too, that the distinction between generous and who do not give is not at all a distinction between rich and poor. It's entirely a matter of the development of the generosity of character. And so I think that might land with a few people on aspects of status and wealth. And the culmination of generosity in an ideal form is the bodhisattva who gives unselfishly out of a deep compassion for all living beings. Compassion is the ultimate aim and the result of a long process of self-cultivation. The other reason why this paramita comes first is that the pleasures and joys of generosity are both attractive and energizing. But like most good things, we have to be careful. So they will see, and I think we talked about this on Wednesday too, about the imperfections in the practices of generosity. And there's sort of the three main categories of, I realize I've got four somehow in here, so we'll just do some imperfections. So, servility, an excessive willingness to serve or please others. And I think there's a lot of people, especially anybody in the classic helping professions, knows what that feeling, where they kind of keep giving and giving and giving, or subservient to other people's wants, needs. And that is actually interpreted as a bit of a contempt for oneself. The habit of unrelenting service fails to take reciprocity into account as the essential ingredient of enlightened social relations. Servile people fail to understand that every person in a community needs to be treated with respect and equal rights, including themselves. Always to set one's own rights aside and thus dismiss issues of self-respect allows others to proceed as though equality and respect are not important. That's sort of another imperfection of generosity is contempt. That was the classic definition, and I think that does apply sometimes for, I think most of us like to believe we don't stick up our nose, but maybe we do, or maybe we hide it under things like pity or blame or a bit of offsettedness. And it certainly, with that kind of focus, offers up the sense of othering, you know, where you're in a position that's a little bit different, you're in a position of generosity, but there's a little bit of that. Yeah, it's a pity, not, you know, I'm a little, you know, a little ego in there, that kind of thing. Poor judgment, giving too much, giving too little, giving ineffectively, so weakening others' capacities to provide for themselves or teaching dependence. Giving the wrong thing. And I think Wright's explanation here, where the traditional teachings recognize that, you know, teachings are powerless if hunger and poverty stand in the way. So it, or if they're kind of inappropriate. I was taught for the first until grade 7 in the Catholic school, and it was very Catholic and very with nuns and everything. And I was waiting for the washroom because we had our time, and I had my hands up, you know, at the doorway because I was next. And somehow my finger slipped between the frame and where the door opens. And the person who finished opened the door, crushing my fingers. So I started yelling, as a child, and I think I was in about grade 5, would do, and hollering at them to close the door, but they kept pushing, and it got worse and worse. And it did draw the attention of the sister who came flying down and saw the situation. And her advice to me was, think of the pain that Jesus suffered dying on the cross. of which I went, yeah, I don't think, sister, that's quite the right one. How about getting her to open the door or close the door so I can get my finger out? But, and I kind of, you know, I hadn't thought of that for ages, but I was like, you know, yeah, there's a little bit of that sometimes, or, you know, or a pat slogan or something like that, which, you know, maybe, you know, but if somebody's distressed, to kind of plant. So I'm just, you know, I just sort of thought, yeah. Anyhow, that's the one that kind of came flying up. Right, he talks better about, not himself, obviously, but how more giving food, you know, volunteering, but maybe not going deeper and getting to root causes. So agencies who end up depending on volunteer work and allowing big companies not to be so generous in giving there, or we can, I'm sure we can all list lots on root causes. And so, you know, is going down to give some socks and a sandwich, the downtown east side, it's generous, but is it looking at the bigger cause? So that's where I kind of look at that. And then another pitfall is merit. And being impartial about everything that might otherwise serve our own egos and desires, but not about the need and situation of the prospective clients, nor about our capacity to be generous and helpful in the future. And I think this is sort of one of where these stickiness, you know, kind of gifts are giving, you know, and what your motivation for giving, kind of tied into the other, not dwelling on the fruits of the act of giving. And then again, here he talks about the Mahayana Buddhists realizing that generosity is best understood as an achievement of a whole society, not individuals, who prize and admire, cultivate practice only to the extent that society's history and language have made that possible. It doesn't suddenly emerge. And that failure to recognize that my achievements are grounded in the achievements of others in my society. So failure to acknowledge that dependence. I that and thought, you know, how, if we're in a position to give, that we didn't get there by ourselves at all, right? And that, you know, it's, and acknowledging that. And I was kind of, I was on the sticky thought and merit and even simple things on when you give something, do you give it really wholeheartedly or do you get that little bit of, you know, if you didn't really get a, oh, wow, it's the best thing ever kind of thing. Or it's the wrong color is the response. I have one that I'm actually, that's come to mind that I'm still dealing with. Is that we've had a few babies that happened in the family. And I'd done something a bit different where they'd done the list and you ordered off of their list, right? And you send it off. But I never got any kind of acknowledgement anywhere on whether the thing had been sent and had arrived at the doorstep and things like that. And that was actually more what my concern kind of was. And so then I talked to my husband, because he's Israel, and I said, you know, I don't know, like, what do you think? Did they get it? Like, you know, does it seem rude to ask? Did you get it? You know, I don't want to sound like, you know, what'd you think or whatever. And so eventually it's like, well, it's bugging me. So I, you know, kind of basically asked, and we were in a gathering, and the response was, oh yeah, we did, but we don't do thank yous. And I went, oh, interesting attitude and response that, you know. And so I've been kind of sitting there. So then I'm like, my reactive and kind of bitchy reactions, well, I don't do gifts then, you know, on that, because it was just like, huh. So then it's like, well, you know, so now I'm kind of more around, well, maybe the next time they have a baby, I'll have to remember it's for the baby, and I'll have to come up with a better way of giving it so that I don't get stuck with wondering if it got lost in the mail or something like that. But, you know, it can kind of happen kind of really you know. Yeah, and did you, yeah, how wholehearted was that? So that's kind of that. So we have skills that are required in the ideal of generosity. We know it can be misguided, it can be misplaced. We know that we can muff it, you know, with all our good intentions. And that's where I kind of keep going back to. And then maybe we need to rely on what we've explored and that we trust in our practice and that we're trust and we're fearless in our practice, that it's not going to hold us back. But it may, you know, even to be fearless enough to examine it and have a little look at it and see where is it and where is it sticking. I do have to say this one because it's like, Wright does the analogy of the teacher to be generous to students while being truthful and just at the same time. So I thought, okay, I probably will see what happens when I ask for feedback from Michael, and I'm sure he'll be lovely. But that whole how to be constructive and not always, you know, happy, happy. And so this relationship of generosity to compassion and learning to feel it. We can't, it's not innate. We can't feel compassion, generosity, simply by deciding to feel it. Or by telling ourselves it's our responsibility to feel it. It comes cultivating our thoughts and our emotions in the practice of giving. And so you try it out on different situations and you know. And Norman and a few others, you know, for most of us, most of the time, we might have a weak capacity for generosity if we're looking at under the lens of how the bodhisattva definitions are there. But to be generous is to awaken to a certain kind of freedom. Momentarily, to be free of ourselves, greed, attachments, resentments, hatreds, habitual and isolating actions of self-protection. So I got chewing around, and then I started to, I'm never really sure on order, but I do think that this notion and the, and I think for our culture in particular, that where we get jammed up a little bit is on this whole notion of the better to give than to receive. And how we fall into that and kind of go back on being overly generous, underly generous, and that it's an outward activity. And so I did a little digging around because it was really around the notion of the circle, giver, receiver, and gift. And like I said, I think most of us are pretty good at giving. Maybe the gift, not so bad. But the receiving is a little bit trickier. And there's writer Ido Reinhardt, and this was, I thought, captured it. It's easier for us to give than receive, and we're reluctant to accept or receive or ask for support. Giving makes us feel good and actually fuels our ego, which likes to think of itself as good, virtuous, and generous. Receiving can make us feel dependent, vulnerable, obligated, powerless, or even ashamed. We don't like to be needy or dependent, and we don't realize that we're already dependent and therefore have a reason to be continually grateful. We deceive ourselves by thinking we are independent and self-reliant and reinforce this idea partly by our efforts to be self-sufficient. Norman kind of talks about the receiving and the difficulty of giving to self, and that this isn't an introductory practice, it's actually an advanced practice. Practicing self-generosity requires that you care about yourself in the same way you care about others, not more, not less, and not easy to do. And so a generous act requires three elements, a giver, a receiver, and a gift, obvious. And generosity and the emptiness of generosity, with the meaning that empty means whole, connected, fluid, free, boundless, emptiness seeing through perfect understanding is inherently imaginative. Since no one owns anything, there is no giver or receiver or gift. Things are not separate from one another. Everything is flow. Everything is complete. So no one owns anything. There is no giver or receiver. It circulates as a gift. So the perfection of generosity is a joyful practice. And so at his end, it's easy. So it's not. So it's easy and it's not. So we kind of go with all of that. Just looking at my time here. So what I said we would do with all of my sort of talks is that it'd be some discussion, it's not a two-way, and then that we would look at kind of exploring a sense exercise, and it's kind of what we, you know, and certainly not traditional in the Zen meditation, but just a way of offering and accessing sensations, attitudes, and things like that, and how they're interpreted in your body. And so on this part, it's optional. I guess it's all optional. You could have zipped me out. And I'll guide you through, I don't even know if it's a guided meditation. I'll guide you through some words. But that you can find yourself a comfy seat, you can find yourself a comfy posture if you want to get on your back or whatever, if you want to leave your Zoom on, you want to take your Zoom off, you want to turn your Zoom audio off, you can do that and check in a few minutes to see where we are. And we're not trying to go for any deep dives here on sensation, but just asking just to sort of consider another point of view. And if you want to stay in your usual Zazen position, that's fine too, whatever is comfortable. And just stay with what's comfortable. If for some reason something strong or profound comes up, just, you know, see if you can set it aside. This is not required. And just, you know, remind yourself that you're in charge of this. So we'll take a few minutes of settling. You can... I'll just scan here and get yourself warm or cool or whatever you need. You can be on your back or on your side, your chair. And as you settle and ease and settle, you may choose to take a cleansing breath. Nice deep breath in and a nice deep breath out. Maybe another deep breath in and out. And then as you relax, you'll just find your own breath pattern that's comfortable for you. And just take a few minutes to take your breath and your body. And then, as before, you could maybe look and be aware of the points of your body that are in contact with your cushion, your seat, your back against a chair, your hands and your lap or on the floor. And as you settle and soften, can you settle in softness into the gentleness of the earth's embrace, the gravity as it pulls and keeps us rooted? And can you ease a little bit more into this support that the earth offers? And can you allow the generosity of space and time, of life itself, to be received and absorbed into your body? And maybe You might see what your hands are doing. They're relaxed, possibly gently open. And looking to your heart space, wherever that might be. And can you raise or open your heart space just a little bit more? It might be by breathing into all the corners of your upper body with the intention of spaciousness. And as you settle and come to a comfortable breath, consider a time when giving and receiving was easy, effortless, and acknowledged. Something small, maybe, private, or even mundane. An example or two might be like when a cat rubs up against your leg, purring softly when you pat them gently. Or a baby who suddenly notices you. And when you smile at them, they smile or giggle in return. Noticing a slightly drooping plant that visibly rises and strengthens a short time after you water it, and you tend to some of its faded leaves. Or some other moment that comes to mind. And when you reflect on that, where do you most feel its impulse? Maybe in the hands, maybe in your heart center or your chest, maybe in more than one place, or maybe it shifts as you roll the little scenario past. And how does it feel? Feel warm. Tingly, relaxed, maybe fearless. And as you quietly reflect, can you perceive the giving moment, gesture, as a sensation? Or the receiving moment as a gesture or sensation. The gift itself. Or maybe you feel it generalized and there is no specific moment, but it's more of a whole. Robert Aitken says, "It is with Dhanaparamita that the Buddhist teaching of universal harmony is put into practice. Mutual interdependence becomes mutual intersupport. It is practice that is not only Buddhist, but perennial as well. The earth itself flourishes by what Emerson calls the endless circulation of the divine charity. The wind sows the seed, the sun evaporates the sea, the wind blows the vapor to the field, the rain feeds the plant feeds the animal. The very stars hold themselves on course through a mutual interchange of energy." So now the invitation will be to bring yourself a little bit back more into alert awareness. You may wish to begin gently moving your hands and feet. Take some fuller breaths. Perhaps a nice stretch or yawn. And gradually, in your own time, return to your seat or Zoom or back into our shared space. Just a little back into the room. So we had on the newsletter, Kate had some suggestions for ways of expressing generosity and some writing. I've sort of suggested coming up with nonverbal expressions of looking at what sensations may or may not have stood out for you, what parts surprised you, maybe, what made you curious, what you noticed or didn't notice, and what you expected to notice. And what can you do to maybe carry some of these practices into your everyday life on how it informs you? And then I thought what might be helpful is from Norman, who has little exercises in his book on daily life practices that you can maybe consider. So, COVID, this is a good one. Wipe counters in public restaurants and recall that you do this for the next person coming in and for the counter itself. Or give yourself a daily gift for a week or more. Stargazing break, a literal pat on the back, or a neck massage. Whatever you can think of. Study how it feels to give the gift and to receive it. Practice saying to someone, "How are you?" and actually mean it. Do something every day for your health and well-being. And a transfer. At the end of the day, offer what goodness you might have generated during the day to someone you know who is sick or having personal challenges and might need help. Alternatively, do something intentional that would generate goodness. Make it your business to call or visit a friend. Give material things. Give the gift of fearlessness. This one is difficult, but it's worthwhile to try it again and again. Look at people with eyes of love, respect, and genuine concern. Try and find those feelings within yourself. And so, and like I said, Don, my lighter, I'm favoring textures and sensations and color. But I know there's a lot of poets and writers out there, so you feel free to write away and express yourself that way. Something there that you might. And then because I like animals, and you find a spirit bodhisattva of generosity. And for me, generosity and for fearlessness, because I think we kind of need both of them. So I got thinking about our little hummingbirds and how they just approach, and they just, my gosh, that tiny little thing sets off from North America to South America and back again. Now, if that doesn't take a little modium fearlessness, I don't know what does, and generosity. So dog, pet, anybody like that, anything or plant, sky, whatever, folks. I thank you for sharing this time with me. May our intentions equally extend to
every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.
I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So we'll go right into our service. We'll be doing the Fozatsu. We'll begin with three bows with the teacher, and then I will share the